Hi, I'm Tim Cole, and welcome to this podcast entitled The World of Data, and welcome to it. Today, we live in a world full of data. Unfortunately, nobody's really sure who owns the data. This isn't as trivial as it may sound. The European Convention on Human Rights says in Article 8, "Everyone has the right to respect for his private and family life, his home, and his correspondence." Legal scholars argue that this means the right of the individual to decide what personal information should be communicated to others and under what circumstances, marking a sharp contradiction to the United States, where, according to legal tradition, the right to privacy is simply the right to be left alone. The closest the U.S. Constitution comes to privacy protection is the Fourth Amendment, which only protects persons and their belongings from warrantless search. So if it's still unclear to whom my data belongs, the Fourth Amendment isn't any help at all. People are very sensitive about these issues, especially in Germany, a country with a difficult history of state-sponsored surveillance, first by the Nazis and then, in East Germany, by the Communists. In 1981, before reunification, when the government in West Germany decided to conduct a census, civil rights activists went to court and won. The poll was postponed, and on December 15, 1983, the Constitutional High Court sent down its historic Volkszählungsurteil, or census decision. And it wasn't until 1987 that the big count could finally take place, albeit with a completely redesigned questionnaire that separated personal from purely statistical data, with the assurance the results would be anonymous. All this was long before surveillance cameras, face recognition systems, and geolocation via smartphone. And we need to remember at this point that computers were still pretty much in their infancy. IBM had launched its very first personal computer in 1981, and large computers, such as those operated by state agencies, still relied largely on punched cards and ticker tape. Even so, the High Court judges worried about what computers might one day be capable of doing. They argued that if citizens could neither know nor influence what information about them was stored and kept available, they would modify their behavior out of fear. This would weigh on their individual freedom to act, and would harm society as a whole, because the free and democratic community depends on the self-determined collaboration of all its citizens. In 1983, Roland Appel published a book entitled "Careful, Census," which inflamed public opinion in the days leading up to the historic decision. Looking back after a quarter of a century, he told me, "It was a big step, but back then, all the state needed to do was confiscate a few punch cards, magnetic tapes, or disk drives to make sure everybody was following the law. Today, things are totally different. Democratic government has a monopoly of power, and it's being challenged by search engines and internet providers. Just like back in the days of the Wild West, we citizens really have no other choice but to take matters into our own hands. Our best protection is no longer the Colt, but a secure browser, software, and an operating system that is safe from intrusion by strangers, be they criminals or agencies of foreign countries, or of our own." The Open Data Institute defines three separate forms of data: closed, shared, and open. In most debates about data privacy, these distinctions are ignored. In fact, it should be clear to everyone that not all data are created equal. If we want to have an informed conversation about data, their use and misuse, we need to accept that in most cases, multiple parties are involved in their creation, processing, distribution, and storage. Nowadays, the big data debate is full of contradictions. There are those who say data are the crude oil of the 21st century, a valuable asset, which means that our data will play an important role in creating wealth and economic growth. Others are afraid of data, which they associate with data theft, attacks on data, and thought police. For these people, data are something we hand over to the state or social web platforms, which then turn around and use them to spy on us. Either that, or the data will fall into the hands of hoodlums who try to steal them from us and use them for their nefarious purposes. Either way, you must protect your data by building walls, in fact, firewalls, around them. A big proponent of this walled garden approach to the internet is my old friend Jaron Lanier, who turned from Paul back to Saul by renouncing his former allegiance to tech. He was, in fact, one of the early but largely unsuccessful players in the virtual reality industry back in the 90s. He recently wrote a book entitled 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media Accounts Right Now. That's pure baloney. No one can turn back the clock, and instead of lamenting, we should be seeking ways to take back our sovereignty over the data we produce. Sovereignty has a nice ring to it, containing as it does the word sovereign, which implies an almost regal dominance, as well as autonomy and independence, but also of calmness and equanimity. We definitely must learn to deal with our data in a sovereign way. Each of us produces masses of data every day. Our smartphones are constantly creating movement profiles without our knowledge. The Fitbit you wear on your wrist is constantly monitoring and recording your vital statistics. Let those data fall into the wrong hands, say your insurance company, and you might find yourself uninsured because of an unknown, previously existing condition. You can thank Donald Trump and his buddies in Congress for that, by the way. When you take your car, which nowadays might be best described as a smartphone on wheels, to a garage, the maintenance guy usually hooks it up to the computer that extracts tons of data that the car has gathered from countless built-in sensors. This data is then transmitted to the car's manufacturer, who uses them to develop new and better cars, but also to create services that he can sell you, just like Apple does with the iPhone, whose purchase price, as outrageously high as it is just a tiny part of the revenue stream it generates for Apple from the apps and services sold over months and years. Nobody asks you if this is okay. They simply assume they have the right to take all your data because it's free. The only reason they can get away with this hoggish behavior is because we have not created a binding moral system governing the use of personal data. The best example in recent times was the Cambridge Analytica scandal, where the marketing company, in partnership with Facebook, was found to have siphoned off the data of at least 87 million users and sent the information, in duly processed form, to Donald Trump's election team, who then used it to massively influence voter choices during the elections of 2016. The reaction from politicians when this came out was typical. First, cover your ass, then ignore the whole thing. To win back sovereignty over our data, we will need to take action. It probably isn't too late to devise a new social contract for the digital age, a set of mutually agreed rules and regulations that protect and empower us as individuals. One could be that we will respect the digital privacy the same way as we do physical integrity. After all, you don't intrude yourself into someone else's personal space by getting too close. And if you do, one could be that we will respect digital privacy the same way we do physical integrity. After all, we don't intrude ourselves into someone else's personal space by getting too close. And if we do, then #MeToo is making such behavior increasingly unacceptable, both morally and legally. About time, too. Kevin Keith of GovHack, a kind of open data hackathon in Australia, calls for a social contract that will allow us to donate our data to something that is bigger than anything. Calls for a social contract that will allow us to donate our data to something that is bigger than any of us. His goal is to establish an ongoing dialogue between governments, business, and civil society that will create enhanced data awareness in each of them long after the dust of the Cambridge Analytica affair has settled. There are a few hopeful signs that this may be happening at the moment. Axiom, the world's biggest data broker, has been collecting information about every single one of us since 1969, which it then sells to advertisers wishing to set up personalized ad campaigns. They have so-called personal profiles of just about everybody, including very personal details, for instance, about our financial and marital status, purchasing preferences, and where we live, including information about who else lives in our neighborhood, and whether they pay their bills on time or not, assuming, of course, that if you live on the wrong side of the tracks, you too may constitute a credit risk. This is called scoring, and it can be astonishingly accurate. Above all, everything Axiom knows about you comes from perfectly legal sources, like land registries, credit agencies, and, increasingly, from websites. Every time we open a web browser and wander with our computer mouse across the page, we are leaving tracks that can be gathered by computers that specialize in such things. One of the tricks of the trade is installing so-called tracking pixels, tiny, invisible, bugging devices on web pages that gather information about us and send it to information harvesters like Axiom. There are lots of companies in the same business as Axiom, and they are all constantly watching us when we go online, whether we actually do anything there or not. Google and Facebook do the same, and if you would like to know what Facebook, for instance, knows about you, all you need to do is log in to your Facebook account and type in the following URL: www.facebook.com/ads/preferences. You will immediately be transferred to a page entitled Your Ad Preferences, and there you will find a list of keywords Facebook has culled from your past visits. Fortunately, it turns out that Facebook is a rank amateur compared to Axiom when it comes to creating meaningful personal profiles. According to Facebook, I am interested in, among other things, traditional Chinese medicine. That was news to me, but presumably at some point in the past, I stumbled across something on Facebook dealing with things like shiatsu, qigong, herbal medicine, or Ayurveda. At least that's what it says on my list. Well, for one thing, Ayurveda is from India, not China, but maybe Facebook is staffed by average American high school students who are famously weak in geography, a subject, by the way, which is no longer taught in some states. In 2014, 3/4 of 8th graders tested below proficiency in geography, according to the National Assessment of Educational Progress, also known as the Nation's Report Card. Anyway, Asian medication is not very high on my personal list, but Facebook begs to differ. Heaven help the advertisers who pay good money for my personal profile and adjust their messages to fit. They will be instantly deleted. Axiom does a much better job. I know this because they let me peek into their database. No, I'm not a hacker. They allowed me to. In September 2013, CEO Scott Howe announced an initiative called AboutTheData.com, which gives everyone the opportunity to access the information Axiom has gathered about them and see if everything is correct. If not, we even get to correct the entry any way we want. Actually, that poses a problem because people, being what they are, sometimes lie. Ladies lie about their age and men exaggerate. Both affectations are bad for the reliability of the results. Axiom has hit upon what I think is an ingenious solution. We get to say what we believe is the truth, but the previous information remains visible. The advertisers that purchase our profiles get to decide who they think is right. If they choose wrongly, their ads will bounce off into cyberspace. Wouldn't it be nice, for instance, if the NSA gave us the same option? But just hold your breath. At the online press conference Axiom gave to publicize their new arrangement, I asked Howe why he decided to give away his crown jewels, so to speak, namely all the well-guarded information that the company presumably spent a fortune gathering. He was very upfront about it. We are beginning to feel the heat from regulators all over the world, so we know that at some point we will be forced to open up. So we decided it's better to be part of the solution than part of the problem. Google and the others would be well advised to take a page out of Axiom's book. Could this usher in a new era in dealing with our data? It really looks like it. In the summer of 2018, Microsoft, Facebook, Google, and Twitter announced their Data Transfer Project, which is intended to make shifting personal data back and forth between online platforms easier, or in fact, possible for the first time. Switching platforms, especially cloud platforms, has been extremely difficult in the past. Riches or a crown may not be forever, but once you signed up with GAFA and such, you have a hard time getting out with your data intact. All that is supposed to change now with the Data Transfer Project. Packing your pictures up on Instagram, say, and copying them over to Flickr should be as easy as moving them from a new folder on your disk drive. Basically, this is what politicians have been demanding for quite some time, especially in Europe, namely open interface data portability. Users should be allowed to move as often as they want, these people say, and even be allowed to make everything on Facebook, for example, go away. At the moment, this right is restricted to the four major players mentioned above, but others are sure to join them over time, and who knows, maybe one day this will become the new world standard. In an interview with the Süddeutsche Zeitung, a German newspaper, data security expert Paul Oliver de Haye says this is a good first step, but he thinks it falls short of what we really need. The really important stuff, he believes, isn't kept with the rest of our personal data, but has long since become part of GAFA's mighty algorithms where they are impossible to extract or even access. Similar criticism has been leveled against Axiom's attempt at opening their databases. On aboutthedata.com, all we get to see is our basic profile, and not the conclusions Axiom has drawn from them. They, however, are what advertisers are so keen to get their grubby little hands on. For instance, Axiom can tell you if you are a potential inheritor, if you live in a household with a diabetic focus, or senior needs, or whether you are an adult with senior parents. Jeff Chester, executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy, believes this is nothing but a small step in the right direction. If you have enjoyed this podcast, please come back and listen to others on www.cole.de. Thanks for listening.